This evening, we have Joanna Kito. Joanna is now a retired psychology and organizational behavior lecturer who's worked both in Hong Kong and in the Isle of Man. Actually, her full title is Dr. Joanna Kito. She is the founder and main lecturer of Living Psychology. It was after many years of teaching psychology that Joanna felt that many traditional academic courses in psychology only partially met people's desire to know about themselves and to gain tools to improve the quality of their life. The main aim of Living Psychology is to address this gap by presenting useful and interesting topics in psychology that are directly applicable to people's everyday and working day lives. The sessions are designed to empower people of all ages to lead happier, healthier, and more productive lives. Today, Joanna's joining us from the Isle of Man, and we've invited her to speak on the topic of owning your own presence. And what does that mean? Stepping into your truth and magnificence. And so if we want to live life as authentically possible, having a greater impact, we're going to need to step into our own truth and be more present in our lives rather than distracted by everything else that happens in the drama of life. And so we've invited Joanna to join us and share her insights on this topic. Joanna, I'm going to hand over to you. Just before I do that, Joanna will be able to take your questions at the end of her talk. You've got a question and answer link in your email. If you'd like to post your questions through that link, I'll be putting your questions to Joanna on your behalf after the talk. Joanna, over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Artie. Let me just start with exploring this idea about magnificence, because I first came across this term, this word magnificence being used in relation to our true self when I was listening to a really interesting account of a near-death experience. And some of you may have come across this sometimes when a person is very ill, or they have had a heart attack or something, and clinically they are it looks as though they are dead, but in fact they are having some kind of an experience of the realms that lie beyond the physical world. And this was somebody called Anita Murjani. And she was actually from Indian parentage. And she actually was living in Hong Kong at the time. And she unfortunately developed cancer. And she was at that stage four cancer. And she'd been admitted to hospital. And all her organs were beginning to just shut down. And then at that point, she had this experience. And it was as if she left her physical body and was looking at her body, but she had this realization that that was not her. And she felt so completely free of all the sort of expectations that she'd carried really as burdens in her life. A lot of them perhaps cultural expectations, because her parents were very traditional, and the feeling that she'd got from them was that she'd never really quite, particularly her father, she'd never really quite lived up to his expectations. But when she was in this state of being outside of her body, she had this realization that all of those beliefs and fears that she'd carried with her and that she felt were actually contributing to her illness were all fabrications of her own expectations of herself, and didn't really have that much to do with what her parents were really thinking or had experienced. So she became completely free, and she sort of realized this truth of herself as a spiritual being, and that this was a kind of a reality about herself that was beyond the scope of the normal reality that we experience with the physical senses. And so when she came back to her body, she felt completely different, because it was as if she just let go of all the baggage. And so often we carry with us so much baggage about our life. And these are all kind of beliefs, and sometimes they're like programs that are just running in the background of our consciousness. And yet they are influencing the decisions that we make and the way in which we interact with people all the time. So it's like we're carrying this baggage. And she, in that moment, had that realization that she could just drop it. And when she dropped all of those fears and beliefs, negative beliefs about herself, she actually began to heal amazingly. And after about 2 weeks, in fact, she was completely better and went back to her life, but completely different life. She started to lead a completely different life, because it was as if she'd really tasted that true potential about herself. And she is a great example of someone who has really, you know, owned that presence and has really started to make a big difference in the world. So this reality of ourself is not something that we, you know, when we look in the mirror, that is not the reality of ourself. We have to go quite a bit deeper. And I was going to show you this quote by a French author called Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, who wrote a lot of books, one of them being The Little Prince. And he said in that book that it is only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential and what is beautiful is invisible to the eye. So, you know, to really experience our true self, we have to look at something that is a reality which is beyond that, the physical reality that normally we consider to be the reality. The good news is that actually we don't, to experience the truth about ourselves, we don't actually have to have a near-death experience. But there are lots of other ways that we can begin to experience ourselves differently. And one of them, of course, is meditation. Because when we practice meditation, it gives us an opportunity to kind of unplug ourselves from the usual world that we inhabit, you know, which is usually quite complex. You know, our daily lives can be very complex, our work lives, trying to create this balance between work and the home roles that we play. So, you know, often when we think about ourselves in relation to those roles and relationships, the expectations that we carry, all of this can create a lot of complexity. And so in meditation, we get an opportunity to be able to just withdraw ourselves from all those expectations and really to explore ourselves from a completely different perspective. And we can start to explore this inner world that we all have. And when we start to really touch that inner world and experience it, one of the main things I think that we can we can find is that all of those things that we tend to look for outside, you know, particularly, I mean, what are the things that so many people are looking for in their day-to-day lives? You know, we tend to look for happiness, we tend to look for love, we tend to look for peace. And those are all experiences that we find, you know, we get temporary experiences of those things. But then so often we lose it. And so when we learn to really explore that inner world and find that richness of our inner world, then those, that reality of ourself, that we are these beings of love, peace, and happiness, and that these are all qualities that we have from the inside. You know, we don't have to go out there and find them. And it's like when we start to own those qualities and experience them, then it, then we are taking at least one step into our truth and into that, the magnificence of our truth. Because if you think about this word magnificence, you know, what is, this was the word, in fact, that Anita used to describe how she felt when she first had that experience. This word magnificence. And I think, you know, when you really explore and experience this, this inner peace and happiness and joy, then the feeling is that there, that feeling is one of magnificence. And it's very easy to touch magnificence when you start to, you know, it's like the building blocks of magnificence are those three basic experiences of peace, love, and happiness. And the second thing also with meditation is that we learn to become the inner observer. So we learn to become the observer of our experience, the observer of our thoughts and feelings. And this is actually a really, really helpful thing, because when we start to become the observer, certainly when I first started meditating, it was actually quite alarming, because I started to realize just how much of the time my thoughts were in fact quite negative. And mostly the revealing thing was that a lot of the negativity was actually directed towards myself. You know, there was a lot of negative thinking about myself. And I hadn't even really been conscious of that, because, you know, I'd just been getting on with my life. And yet, I certainly carried with me certain insecurities. And I hadn't really connected somehow that this was to do with the beliefs, the sort of deeper subconscious beliefs that I was carrying. And I think we all carry these subconscious beliefs, because from the age of about, up to the age of about seven, we're like these little sponges, and we tend to internalize the beliefs and the ways of being of our, you know, main caregivers or the people around us or you know, the people that we grow up with. But particularly those first 7 years are really influential in terms of just absorbing beliefs. And sometimes we carry these beliefs with us into our adult life without even really being that conscious of what those beliefs are. So, you know, these beliefs can be, it's like they drive, they're like programs that are running in the background of our mind, and it's as if they're sort of driving our life in the sense of our responses to things, for example. And I feel that there is, you know, one kind of category of beliefs, which is just so common. And I always call them the not enough beliefs, or the not enough syndrome. And the first aspect of this not enough syndrome, or one of the aspects of this not enough, is that I feel that I don't have enough. So I think we're all familiar with that, and that's maybe comes from a kind of an emptiness, and it's this emptiness that often fuels a lot of the consumer society that we live in. But more prevalent even than that one, I think, is this I'm not good enough. And this particular belief is very connected to another one, which is I'm not doing enough. Because I think in our society, what is valued is what people do. And so, you know, this is why sometimes when people start meditation, they find it really difficult, because the feeling is, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm not actually doing anything. So, you know, how can it possibly be something that's really valuable? So I'm not enough. You know, I may not even actually ever say that to myself, you know, consciously. I may not say, oh, I'm not good enough. And yet it can still be driving our behavior. And I may not even be aware of it. A few weeks ago, actually, I met a social worker, and they came here to do the meditation course. And he was actually off with stress. So he was a social worker, but he was signed off by his doctor with stress. And when I was asking him about his work, he was saying that he had got into a situation where he was really so conscientious that he was working very late hours. And under this umbrella of conscientiousness, it was as if it was the sort of a justification for him completely wearing himself down and not taking care to have an adequate balance in his life. And when he started to meditate, first of all, he realized that he had a lot of these patterns of thinking about himself, which were negative. But also he started to become aware that, you know, what was actually driving him was this feeling of not being, you know, of not being good enough. And so he felt that he was always trying to compensate for that. And that was why he was actually overworking. So you can see how when we have this kind of programming, it makes us actually very vulnerable to stress. And also it's very easy to become overwhelmed by setbacks because we don't feel that we have the ability to cope. And of course, that's just our perception. And that's quite an interesting a definition of stress, is that one that I mention quite a lot, because it's like a mismatch between the demands of a situation and my perception of my ability to cope. So the stress is actually not the situation, but it's driven by my perception of my ability to cope. And of course, if I've got all this programming going on, then it's very difficult for me to be present to my life, and also present to the positive qualities that all of us contribute in our daily lives. You know, we just don't notice that. We tend to kind of get fixated on the things that we do wrong, or the things that we're not doing well enough, you know, another enough. So this brings us to this understanding, or an understanding of when we're being driven by these programs, it's as if we're on on a kind of autopilot. You know, one way of being on an autopilot is just not being present to whatever's going on. You know, I'm thinking about something in the past. But the definition of, the actual autopilot as it was originally used, which was on an aeroplane, and the pilot would switch on to autopilot when the plane was cruising. And the definition of it is that it keeps the aircraft on a set course without the intervention of the pilot. And so the pilot is actually absent at the time. And, you know, this is a bit like what can happen in our lives, is that we're being driven by these past programs, and we're not really that aware of them because we're too busy trying to accomplish everything that we feel we need to accomplish in our life. But it's like we've got this handicap of these beliefs. And, you know, we're on this set course, and this set course that's been mapped out is not one that really has been set by us. It's often been set by all these beliefs that we have internalized. And so it's really important to become very conscious of what it is that is driving us, because this is often what determines how present we are in day-to-day situations. There was a very interesting study which I'd just like to mention, because it describes this in that it was by a psychologist called Farb, and he wanted to find out about how do people experience their moment-to-moment reality. You know, what's going on when people have their moment-to-moment experience. And he found that there were two types. And one type was, in fact, where the default network memory regions of the brain were really, really active. And this is when we're kind of holding a sort of a story or a narrative about ourselves or about other people. And it takes no effort to trigger it. So it's like the outside world is always being processed through this kind of a filter, you know, through the story that we keep telling ourselves about life. But whilst we're telling a story about life, we're actually not experiencing life directly as it is. And so that was the second type of moment-to-moment experience, that where people were completely present to what was going on and there was no filtering. They were just experiencing what was there. And of course, this is when we start to experience the truth about ourselves, our true qualities, and we become present to our inner truth, not just what's going on externally, you know, through our senses, but actually we start to bring that presence into our everyday interactions, then it's like we're no longer caught up in this whole storytelling about ourselves. Because the dangers of being on this autopilot is that we actually miss out on the signs and signals that keep us safe. You know, there are lots of road signs that tell us to kind of stop or slow down or don't go down here. And in fact, in our life, we also have lots of signs and signals that life gives us. Just like, for example, this social worker, you know, he knew his body was telling him that he was overworking, but he didn't listen because this drive of, you know, I'm not good enough and I've got to prove myself was the kind of noise that prevented him from actually listening to the those signs and signals. And I've heard many examples of this. Just need to keep an eye on the time as well. I've heard many examples of this over the years. So many people who've come to the centre have come because they have just not listened to their body or to their to the signals that their life was giving them, that that they were just not keeping that the necessary kind of balance. So how can we become more present and more conscious of this inner being and all these qualities and powers that we have inside of ourselves? So I've thought about this and I've put together a few little tools that I thought that I found useful and that certainly other people have found useful. So I'd like to just share some of these tools with you now. The first tool is creating new pathways. And this is where we start to become conscious of the difference between being on autopilot versus being a conscious creator of our thoughts and our experience. Now, when we look at psychology and how much the field of neuroscience has developed in the last 10, 20 years, it's really just grown and grown hugely. And one of the most exciting things that they found is this understanding of neuroplasticity, because there was a time when people felt that actually intelligence and our personality, all of those things, they were just not subject to change, and that once we reached a certain age, that was it. It was all kind of fixed. But in recent times, this idea about neuroplasticity has changed all of that. And it's really been amazing, a revolution, I think, in terms of our way of thinking. Because this idea that our brains are malleable, you know, we can change. It's not all fixed at all. And I often use this example of thinking about our mind as like a field of long grass, and that where people have been crossing that field quite a few times. And so there are a number of different tracks across the field where the grass has been worn down. And this is very much like what happens in our mind, is that we begin to develop particular patterns of thinking, and that those patterns, the more that we think them, the stronger that they get. And so they become kind of very easily default in those circumstances. But when we start to notice what our beliefs are and we start to challenge them, and then we can start to become very active in terms of creating new patterns of thoughts. And particularly when we are present to our peace, our love, our inner joy, then it becomes much easier for us to create new thoughts, which allow us to experience life very differently, just by choosing different ways of thinking about ourselves, first of all, but also about others and about the situations that we find ourselves in. So this was the first tool that is about creating new, you know, creating new thoughts, creating positive thoughts, creating thoughts that align ourselves with our original way of being, that original soul way of being. The second one is something that I came across quite recently, and it's actually a kind of physical thing that you can do. And I was going to demonstrate it to you, but it's a little bit more difficult now that I'm holding my phone. And that is, you know, when you are victorious, you know, when somebody is a victor, when they've won something and they put up their arms in a V, I can only put up one arm, and they put their arms up in a V. Well, I was reading something somewhere where it was saying that if you do this two or three times a day and smile, so the smile is also really important, it actually boosts your mood and it really helps you to feel more positive about yourself. I think it must be some kind of an association, but I'd like you just to try that now, wherever you're sitting at home, and just I really felt when I did it that it made a really good positive, you know, I had this really positive feeling of being victorious, of winning. So this is also something that you can try, and you can let me know if it works. The third tool, let's see now, I've just got my slides here, fortunately, ones I was going to show you. Yeah, the third tool I thought about was, and I think it does come after we've practiced the first tool, you know, when we start to make our mind more positive, our mind naturally, we naturally find that we can create more stillness with our mind. And I feel that being able to take time for stillness is actually really important, because this place of stillness is the place that we can go that is beyond the programming. And it's almost as if we're coming back to that zero, you know, that original self before we got all these different beliefs that we picked up along the way. And I think it's in this stillness, and this is why, you know, when we're about to make a decision, it's good to take a bit of time just for quiet, inner quiet, because it frees us up to look at all the different possibilities that there are, rather than just going down the usual track. It means that we can find a sort of a neutral place inside where we can find a new possibility that we can experiment with and experience. So that's the third tool. And the fourth tool, which is something that I found is really important when we start to become more aware of our feelings, because of course, when we create space for ourselves inside, it's not always the positive feelings that come up. And I think when, for example, something like fear or anxiety comes up, the natural response is to try to distract ourselves from it and not go there, if you like, or just create a different kind of thought. And that is one strategy. But I also feel that sometimes when we push these negative feelings away, we never really understand why they're there and what kind of message they have for us. And I think we can learn an awful lot about our sort of programming or our beliefs by just listening to, you know, for example, if I experience fear, and if I just ask myself, you know, I welcome that fear rather than just pushing it away. And I just kind of interview it and say, well, you know, what exactly is it that you are afraid of? And then I find I start to get some really kind of interesting answers. So it's like the fourth tool is to be very compassionate with whatever comes up in that space of stillness, and just be a kind of a listener to our own selves, like a friend to our own selves. Actually, it reminded me of that amazing poem by the Sufi poet, which I'm sure many of you will be familiar with, The Guest House. There's a paragraph in that poem which I just like to read, and then I'm going to stop. So it's about our thoughts being like visitors to a guest house. So one of the paragraphs says, "Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight." So it's like paying attention to those feelings, but not getting lost in them, but not rejecting them either. Okay, so let's take a bit of time for ourselves. So just sit very comfortably. I'm just going to prop this because it's better. And take your attention inside and become aware of your inner world of thoughts and feelings. This is a world for which I am the creator. And there are times when my thoughts and feelings seem to be driving me. But when I take this time to go inside and experience the richness of my inner being, then I start to explore all the treasures that I have inside. I touch that treasure of peace. And when I am peaceful, I can be present. That presence, that truth that I carry within me, is always there for me. But so often I allow the busyness of my day-to-day life to impinge. But for this moment, I am this being of peace. I am this being of love. I carry this joy within me. And I just need to make that time to touch those qualities within. And then I start to feel my inner magnificence emerging. This greatness is the greatness of every soul, every being. And all I need to do is to go inside and emerge these feelings and just be with that experience. Taste it, feel it, and bring it out into my life. I am this amazing being. Each one of us carries this greatness within.
Wow, thank you, Jo. I'm going to say thank you for holding the phone for all that length of time. Your arm must ache from it, that's for sure. But thank you. It's really appreciated it. The first question I have for you is, what if these visitors in our mind make us uncomfortable? Should we not ask them to leave and not detain them?
Well, I think they leave. What I've experienced, because this is something I've only been experimenting with quite recently, because before I used that first tool much more, you know, just always, oh, you know, that was, I'm feeling, this feeling is making me uncomfortable. Let me create a different feeling. But I found that I never really got to the bottom of what the fear, which is what I was experiencing, was all about. And it was only actually when I engaged with that feeling, I think it's something that you will just have to experiment with, and engaged in a very loving way. I think that's the important thing. Because when you engage with it, and it's like you become like a kind of a parent to it. Because I feel that a lot of these, you know, as I said before, a lot of these feelings often begin when we're really quite young. And I felt that this fear that I had, still have at times, was like a little child that was very anxious. And it was only when I said, "You're welcome here," that it began to relax. And it's like the fear seemed to just dissipate so much, you know, it just sort of, it relaxed. And so I feel that it is just a different way. And I think, you know, we each of us have to experiment for ourselves as to what works for us.
Thank you. The next question is, how do I bring more awareness to the beliefs that are stopping me being present, as they seem to be in disguise of being a good person? Life just seems to be so fast-paced to give this time. Do you have a super simple tool?
I wish I did. I'm afraid. I think that is often what happens when we're busy, is that it is very difficult to really get to grips with what these beliefs are. But I mean, you know, mostly they are these, I'm not good enough, you know, very often they come down to that in some shape or form. And so even if I just work with that one and challenge that belief and really give myself different ways of thinking about myself primarily, I think that, you know, that's a starting point. None of these things are quick fixes. They really aren't. It takes time to change beliefs, I feel. But I think we can start with just looking at the thoughts that we have and starting to change the thoughts that we have. That's a very good starting point. You know, we have to start somewhere. I think sometimes also these beliefs just, you know, they will make themselves known to us when it's the right time. We can't just sort of clean out the house all in one go. We have to allow it to unfold in its own time as well, sometimes without forcing. I know it means that we have to go through often periods of time which are quite uncomfortable, but that's often just part of the journey.
Lovely. The next question. When you are creating a pathway, like you were talking about, in the initial steps, when it doesn't feel real, and the stage of fake it until you make it, how can you keep at it and not give up? Do you have any tools for that?
Yeah, well, it's great because all these questions just, you know, they remind me of things that I've thought myself. Absolutely. Well, the truth is that, you know, often we do give up. But, you know, what I find is that if it's something that I really want to do, I will come back to it and I will start again. And I can tell you, I've had to start again and again and again and again. And that's the only way, is because each time it's like I've learned something else. You know, it's like I'm gaining knowledge about myself. And I'm not sure that there are a lot of, I'm sorry to say this, but I'm not sure, well, apart from having a kind of dramatic experience like Anita Moorjani, there's not always that many shortcuts to it, you know. But just the more that we can do that, I think it's the feelings that are important. You know, we can say the words, we can create the words, but the most important thing is that I feel it. And that's why something like meditation is really helpful, because it gives me the opportunity to experience a new pathway, you know, a new way of thinking, in the sort of privacy of my own inner world. And it's as if I can, you know, I can rehearse that in a sort of a safe space, and I can imagine myself thinking that in a normal situation. You know, I can visualize myself thinking that particular thought, and then it becomes more real because it's like I'm actually experiencing it in my mind. And we And we know that, you know, the more that you experience something, the more likely it is to actually sort of become a reality externally. You know, the more we internally rehearse it, the more likely it is to become a reality in my daily life. But often in my daily life, I don't always have time to create something new because, you know, we're too busy and we're too sort of driven by our usual responses. So it's like taking that time outside of that situation and using that as a kind of rehearsal time.
Interesting. Thank you. The next question is, I'm aware I can't avoid everyone. However, there are times I don't like talking to people because it may trigger a negative thought pattern within me. Or I may pick up another person's negative thoughts. Do you have any suggestions or tools on how to deal with this?
Could you just say that again? I sort of missed a little bit of that.
I'm aware that I can't avoid everyone, but there are times that I don't like to talk to people as they may trigger negative thoughts. Or I may be with someone and pick up their negative thoughts. How would you deal with this situation?
Well, I mean, I think you're saying, well, what I'm sort of understanding that you're saying there is that sometimes you don't feel like interacting with people and you maybe feel you should. But I think, you know, so long as we, you know, sometimes we don't have, you know, sometimes that's an expectation that we have of ourselves, you know, that we have to interact with people. But sometimes we can just say to people that, you know, I need this quiet time or I have something else to do at this moment. But, you know, if we are kind of pleasant and friendly, and, you know, sometimes it's about having boundaries that, you know, we often feel that that we can't say no to people or you know, we have to always be there when they want us to be there or whatever. But actually, I think, you know, sometimes part of self-respect is actually knowing what it is that I need at this moment and being able to communicate that to people clearly and sort of with that same self-respect. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know whether I've answered the second part of that question now. Sorry, I'm trying to retain both bits of the question.
Being with people and picking up on their negativity.
Oh, yeah. All right. Okay. So with that, if you just surround yourself, you know, before you go into that situation or before you're going to be with people or whatever, if you surround yourself with like a little bubble and you fill that bubble with whatever quality it is that you want to experience and maybe give out to people, then it's like we become, you know, all of this is about being the creator of our inner world rather than being a vacuum cleaner, you know, which is often what we're doing, is that we become like a vacuum cleaner and we go out there and we just hoover in everybody else's vibrations. But instead of being a vacuum cleaner, if we could be, you know, like those smelly things you hang in a wardrobe, which gives off a really nice fragrance, so that we're giving out something positive. So it's like my energy is going into sort of creating that positive experience within me that I'm giving out to others. And then I'm not nearly so susceptible to picking up their thoughts or their vibrations. So I hope that answers
that question. I think it does. The next question is, can these tools be applied to OCD, like thoughts that are reoccurring, like thoughts that keep reoccurring like a broken record on a daily basis?
Well, yeah, I mean, I would just encourage you to try and to experiment with that. You know, these compulsive thoughts. I mean, I would say that if you know, sometimes we need to get professional help with these kind of conditions, because you know, it's like you'll probably find that the professional person would have very similar kinds of tools actually, but they would get you to challenge your, the thoughts and come up with different thoughts. But sometimes we need that kind of one-to-one help if it's very persistent and you know, difficult to you know, if you try these tools out and you find that you know, it's still persisting, then that's maybe something you need a bit of help with.
Lovely, lovely. I have one more question for you this evening, and that is, can you give an example of how a thought can be changed? In your talk, you spoke about stress. So can you give an example in relationship to that?
Stress, yeah. Well, for example, you know, like I said, that the definition, or a definition of stress, is that it's a mismatch between the demands of the situation and my perception of my ability to cope. You see, what often happens is that we are saying things to ourselves. Often, you know, sometimes we're conscious of it, sometimes we're not all that conscious of it. And it's often a feeling that comes up. And the feeling is maybe one of fear, but often the thought pattern that has gone before that has been something like, you know, I'm not going to be able to cope with this situation. Because this is the main reason why we feel stressed, is not because of the actual situation, but there's a fear that I just don't have the resources to be able to deal with it. And so that accentuates the whole situation. So I feel we have to be very, very encouraging to ourselves and learn how to, you know, just like a parent would have been, you know, a good parent. I mean, some of us have had good parents, but many of us have not really had all that brilliant parenting. And certainly now, I think there's a lot more information of what a good parent says to a child, and you see it a lot more in schools now. You know, teachers are really, really very good at these kinds of skills, where they constantly kind of say, well done, you know, all the time they're saying, like, well done, you've done this. And they focus on what the child has done rather than what the child can't do or isn't doing. And I feel that we have to learn to do this for ourselves and encourage ourselves and say, yeah, you know, you can do this. You're perfectly able to cope with this. Just look at what you've coped with before, and just look at the qualities that you have that you can bring out and bring to this situation. So it's like a kind of an inner encouragement, and I feel that, you know, if we can develop these kind of habits of thinking, then a lot of stress will be reduced, because a lot of stress is to do with our own expectations. And if I can learn to if I learn to look at those expectations and let go of those expectations, then we would find a lot of our stress would disappear.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you very much, Joanna. And thank you to the audience who joined us today. And we hope to see you soon. Good night, everybody.